G'day and welcome to episode 4 of season 2 of The Coriolis Effect. Jernringen, the Iron League. I'm Dave.
And I'm Matthew. And you may already have heard, but we've got some exciting news about Free League and Jernringen. Did you just say Jernringen?
I might have done, actually. Hang on. So, everyone, the title of the episode is Jernringen. The Iron League, not Jernringen. The Iron.
Do you want to, shall we start again?
No, just keep going. It's fine. And we were just talking about how professional we were being this morning. Oh well, it never lasts
there
for long.
There we go.
Anyway, carry on, Matt.
Jernringen, the Iron League. That's the episode now, and we are going to be talking in the world of gaming. We've got some gaming news about Things of the Flood. Of course, it's the last few days of that Kickstarter. Judge Dredd is kickstarting, but the big news is the merger, more of which anon. We also want to have a bit of a chat about Forbidden Lands. We all played our first game. The first couple of episodes of that have gone out on our
actual play
feed, yeah, as it were. And we just wanted to kind of give it a little bit of a review, having played it, and particularly in the light of this news, compare it with Simbaroom.
Yeah, there's going to be some interesting stuff to talk about, actually, both sort of on the merger and the, you know, what happens to those two games, which are in essence quite similar, similar in principle anyway,
in some principles, yeah. yes so hopefully they both have a long life ahead of them though.
Well, absolutely.
We also want to talk about Dragon Meat, where we will be appearing as part of the podcast zone.
We will.
And we are working on a rather special treat for attendees of Dragon Meat, which will be Forbidden Lands related, but we'll tell you some more about that at the time. And I've got I promised last week, a new mechanic that's been inspired by my single game of playing The Expanse Quickstarter. So we'll talk about that. And then I think you've had a good session of Spectral Corsair.
Yeah, we had a good game. I'll update people on that as well. Now, I can't remember if last time I took the homework from you to talk a bit about the Liberator that I've worked on for Coriolis for our next game in the...
gave me the homework to talk about Expanse, but I think we discussed Liberator outside this, and Nobody knows about that.
So what is going to be sort of incorrectly called the Mukafar campaign, seeing we don't actually have the Mukafar anymore as a ship? You gave me a task to put together some ideas around a Liberator starship, a Blake 7 Liberator starship that we find in the next scenario. So I haven't done that because with the merger and other stuff,
We've had other things to talk about. We'll do that in the next episode.
But I'll put that together.
Don't spoil the next episode until we get to the next episode section, Dave.
Okay, fair enough. Right then. Well, let's talk about the
merger.
Let's
get stuck in.
Yeah. So, Jernringen and Free League are coming together under the banner of the Free League.
Now, all we've officially heard about this kind of officially in, I haven't heard it because it's in Swedish, and is their podcast. So they released an episode 39 of Signaler von Zonen. That's me being really bad at speaking Swedish.
Signals from the Zone, yeah.
Signals from the Zone, where they announced the merger there. We're expecting today, Friday, as we record, maybe some more public announcements online and on their stores.
Nils tipped me off, Nils Carlin from Free League tipped me off that this was coming today, that there was going to be a formal official announcement today. Friday the 5th of October today. And that was great. He then came back to me and said, oh, actually, we've spilled the beans on the podcast, so you can talk about it if you like.
You started putting it on Google Plus, and yep, I announced it on our Twitter stream and Facebook as well. And we've had a bit of interest there. So tell me though, you had a chat with Nils. What did he say about this merger?
Well, it was a fairly brief chat, but he was really excited by it. And I think you could always look at these kind of mergers. Is there something, what's the motivation for doing it? Is there Is there a bad thing that's led to this happening? Or is this just a really good evolution of what's going on? And the sense I've got from Nils and then from some of the other guys is they seem really excited. And it doesn't feel like this is a desperate attempt to prevent something bad from happening. And it's really a natural progression for them. So they've worked together for years, these guys. You know, originally Jan Ringen created Coriolis in the first place. Matthias Lilja and Matthias Jonsson and obviously Martin Grip were behind all of that. And the Free League guys came along as freelance writers and producers. So they've known these guys for years and years and years. And I remember when we spoke to the Jan Ringen guys when we were in Sweden, you know, this time last year.
Yeah, about a year ago. Yeah.
Yeah. They were saying that it just got a bit much running the business, as well as having jobs, as well as having family lives and everything else, which is why they kind of brought it to a close then. But then they realised a few years later that actually making games was great fun. But obviously it's really hard work. And I think they're both the Jan Ringen guys and Nils and Costa from Free League were telling us, this is a dream to be having a job that you're working on, your hobby, the things that you love. But actually, when it becomes a job, it becomes more serious and it can become a lot less fun.
Yeah, when you're starting to deal with, you know, credit and printing schedules and stuff like that, the creative bit of the job is still fun, but it's weighed down with tax returns and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this is a really, really good move, because, I mean, first and foremost, the quality and the high bar of professionalism that surrounds both these companies is excellent. You know, second to none. You know, the quality of the games, the quality of the production values, the artwork, everything, it's all absolutely top-notch. And bringing them together, I think the one thing that I just thought when they were talking about it is that obviously now the new Free League, you've now got Martin Grip and Simon Stålenhag in the same company. Mm. So two of my favourite artists out there, you know, you are force multiplying what you can do in the one company by bringing everybody into the same team. And the same goes obviously with the other creative talent, you know, Matthias, Thomas, Nils, Kostas, Ricard, Christian, and everybody else. I've probably forgotten somebody who's going to get really grumpy if they listen to this and they think, why haven't they mentioned me? Yeah, so I think that seems like really good development. Yeah, and it kind of makes sense as well, because, you know, not just Coriolis was originally within Jan Ringen. They had Mutant Heirs of Doom in the first place, which then became eventually Mutant Year Zero. So, yeah, I think it's an absolutely obvious and natural thing to do. Sounds great to me. I think it bodes really well.
And I think, you know, my outside perception of both companies now, you know, my relationship with Jan Ringen isn't quite the same as yours, in that I've not bought any stuff off them. You are the Simba Room GM.
Yeah.
But my impression as a slight outsider of that is that Freya Ligan have got their kind of production line sorted, and Jan Ringen's creativity coming into that is going to be brilliant, I think. Well, now, we've also...
It's interesting as well, I think, how Freya Ligan have taken off in these last 2 or 3 years with, you know, they've now got a number of products in the pipeline simultaneously. You know, you've got Things from the Flood, you've got Crusader Kings. You know, there's so much stuff that they're now doing that is coming through that, like you say, it looks like they've cracked, you know, unless they're enormously overburdening themselves, it looks like they've cracked that process of getting that game through the system and out the other end. With Jan Ringen, they've only really got the one game, certainly that I'm aware of, and I'm sure they've got plans for other things. So maybe part of the merger is giving Matthias Lilja and Matthias Jonsson the bandwidth to be able to focus on some of the other stuff and actually help them produce more games. Yeah, it sounds like a good thing.
Cool. We ought to also say that we've had a bit of a preview of our friend Doug's interview with Matthias Jonsson and Thomas Arenstam which should be dropping on YouTube some point today.
Victory Condition Gaming, yeah.
On his channel, yeah.
So that's a really interesting discussion, isn't it? I mean, go and have a look at that. And you can see Thomas and Mateus, you know, side by side, obviously have known each other for a long time. It just seems entirely natural, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it brings us to what are the changes we're going to see? Because one might argue, how does this impact us as particularly, you know, if we're not Swedish and we don't know these guys personally, because everybody in Sweden knows each other personally, don't they? or so it seems in the gaming world there, at least. Yeah. But for those of us outside, what does it mean? Some things came to light there. So the first thing that comes to mind is there's a slight delay to the Swedish release of the next part of the, is it called the Iron Crown campaign in Simba Room?
Throne of Thorns.
Throne of Thorns, yeah. That's it, yeah. Now, their model has been to release that, I got the impression, without a Kickstarter in Swedish, and then to kickstart the English translation and production.
Yes, I think that's right.
Now, of course, in a way, that's what Free League had been doing up until Forbidden Lands, where that was, you know, co-production in both languages, kickstarted at the same time and released in Swedish and in English at the same time. And it seemed to me that that's what they're planning to do with that next part of the campaign in Simba Room.
Yeah, I think that probably works quite well, because one of the sort of criticisms, I think, of the approach that they'd taken and the approach that Free League had taken in the first place was that I think the Swedish community, albeit they got their hands on the content and the product first, they got their hands on that and almost acted a bit as a,
beta testers,
yeah, exactly. And so I think maybe there was, you know, a thought that it would be better to get it to the finished point for all their customers rather than just for their international ones.
Yeah, and I think we've seen in Coriolis, which of course was released in Swedish long before the English translation, that there were some slightly weird repetitions and things of stuff that was created for the Swedish game as a supplement, but then rammed into the core book that we got in English, and stuff that didn't fit into the core book that we got as a supplement, which is a supplement the Swedish guys didn't get. But they got all that information, but it was spread over either their core book or a number of different supplements. So this homogenization of both versions, English and Swedish, is only going to help us as a fan community know what we're all talking about when we're talking to each other.
Yes, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? I think the other thing that came up, which was something I mentioned to Nils, was, okay, great, that does that mean we get Simba Room with the Year Zero engine in it?
Yay, let's have that!
But the answer was no.
No.
I can completely understand that, actually. So I guess this merger does bring a wrinkle here in that, you know, they've both got a fantasy role-playing game that's in some senses are very similar to each other, but in terms of, sort of game mechanics are very different. And it does, yeah. Is there going to be a catfight there between Forbidden Lands and Simba Room about which one is the dominant force for the new Free League in terms of pushing it forward? And I would hope that, you know, the games are very different, and the feel, I think, of the games are both very different. But there is still a risk that one or t'other could wither on the vine a little bit, because people who go to Free League for a fantasy role-playing game might only pick up one of them rather than pick up both.
Yeah, but then again, I think, you know, there are different preferences. I'd love to have Simba Room with the Year Zero engine, because I like the Year Zero engine and I like dice pools and I don't like D20,
yeah,
as regular listeners to this podcast will be bored of hearing. But, but there are, believe it or not, Dave, there are people out there that like D20, that like to be able to say, if I've got, you know, I've got 75% chance of rolling 15 or under, you know, I know where I am with that, and they don't like the dice pool mechanic. So I am, if funny enough, we weren't going to mention this, we'd drop this in the news because we've got so much, but a new version of RuneQuest has come out. Now, RuneQuest is a game that we all played, you and I played sort of 30 years ago.
You're just determined to talk about RuneQuest, aren't you? Here was me saying, well, we agreed.
There's a thing here.
We agreed we didn't have time for this, Matt. You know, put it... But no, you have to just mention it anyway.
There's a point there. There's a point here of similarity.
Unusually for us, we've got a point. Okay, you better crack on then. You better say it.
Chaosium have got not one, not two, but three game systems that run the world of Glorantha in that they're currently selling. So if you want the sort of simulationist game that RuneQuest was, then they've got a new version of RuneQuest. It's just come out. If you want a more gamey version, a bit like D&D, they've got 13th Age in Glorantha. And if you want a more Fate-like sort of narrative system, they've got HeroQuest. So they're running three game systems. They're publishing three game systems for three different sorts of people. And they're all set in the same world.
Yeah, that's so true, actually. Yeah, there's another example, which is actually you had to reduce its scope a bit, but Talos Lanta, which is kickstarted and is... I'm still waiting for the hard copy stuff to come through. They deliberately, in the Kickstarter, decided to create a number of versions of that with different mechanics, deliberately to cater for people who like one mechanic over another, which I thought was a really good idea, even though they had to draw their teeth a little bit for various reasons. But they're still doing two or three versions of that.
So, you know, I think there's scope for a company to have two fantasy worlds and two fantasy systems. But my favourite will always be Forbidden Lands. Mm. Except I love the artwork in Simbroom. Forbidden Lands and Simbroom art books, that's the way forward. They're not going to merge those systems. I think they are going to merge websites. I think we'll see a merged website today, even, from what they were telling Doug in his video. And the other interesting thing, there's a slight change to distribution. They both still work with Modiphius, so that won't change. I think that relationship of Modiphius being their kind of English language distributors will carry on. But Free League hasn't had a direct relationship with Drive-Thru RPG, the PDF sales store. And Yanringen does, so I think we'll see now the combined Free League selling all their PDFs through Jan Ringen's sort of presence on the store rather than Modiphius's.
Mm. Yeah, it's another interesting point, actually. Presumably, with this merger, Jan Ringen as an entity is going to be wound up. So there won't be a Jan Ringen anymore. So I guess that maybe that presence on Drive-Thru then has to become a Freer Ligaen presence rather than a Jan Ringen one.
Yeah.
But yeah. At least, though, it's good that there's a place there that gamers, another place there that gamers can get their hands on Free League content, because you should get your hands on Free League content because it's really good.
Yes. And it hopefully means that those of us who got it through Kickstarters will have the ability to download things more easily. I mean, they have managed to do that with some of the games, but not all of the games. And we've been able to download copies for free from Drive-Thru, which is obviously a great repository of PDFs, and it would allow us to review them on Drive-Thru as well. I remember with Coriolis, I've written quite a long review, and of course, because I hadn't bought it from Drive-Thru,
you could
in the comment section of the Drive-Thru page. So yeah, I think generally good things. There are no bad things in this thing, as far as I can see.
No, as I said, I think the only thing would be that slight delay for the Swedish community on the next, I think it's episode 4 of the Throne of Thorns. But I thought it was also, just to wrap up on this piece, I thought it was really interesting. So you've got Free League and you've got Yenringen, and Free League's logo is a lily, which is designed because Matthias Lilja from Yenringen was one of the key creative forces behind Coriolis in the first place, and now they're all coming together. So I think that there is a sense of continuity, as well as a sense of there being something a bit new, which I think is great. So good luck to the guys. I hope it works out really well, and look forward to many more years of top quality stuff from the new Free League.
Yeah. And so the new Free League has currently got a Kickstarter going. There's only a few days of it left. Things from the Flood.
Yep.
Have you kicked in, Dave?
I have. Yes, I have.
Of course.
yeah. It's interesting.
What sort of level have you kicked in at?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'll have to log into Kickstarter to do that. But it's the usual level that I go for, which is where you get the physical copies of
the extras,
the main stuff, and the extras without going to the two deluxe level.
Deluxe line. Well, I've kicked in at a level below that currently. I just wanted the book because, you know, I didn't buy the book when you did. I bought it from my friendly local gaming store.
And what, for Tales from the Loop?
Tales from the Loop, yeah. And so with this one, I was thinking, well, I carry on the same thing. I mean, arguably, I thought I might even just have a PDF version and treat it as an expansion. Mm-hmm. I got to say, though, those extras, particularly, you know, now they've got all those stretch goals in there and there are all sorts of things included with the next level up, the rocker level.
Yeah.
I'm inclined maybe to put my bid up to that.
You know you want to. You know you want to.
I know I want to.
You know you want to. Although I will say one thing though, of all the, they just unlocked the custom dice yesterday or the day before.
Yeah.
And of all the custom dice that I've come across, the ones for Tales from the Loop are the ones I hate the most. I think they're horrible. And similarly,
well, in terms of design, or in terms of the fact they keep rolling successes.
Well,
you're the GM.
That's true. But in terms of design, I think no, I don't like them. I'm not going to send my Things from the Flood dice back, of course, when I get them. But still.
But that's not the thing you're looking forward to.
No, no. I thought it was really interesting your interview when you co-hosted with Doug from Victory Condition Gaming about Things from the Flood. I mean, the one thing I wanted you to ask and you didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. What?
I know.
You should have
sent
me a message.
I know.
What should I have asked?
Well, it's just about, is this Free League's version of Tales from the Loop plus Cthulhu? Is that? Or is this actually Free League's merger of Tales from the Loop and Cult rather than Cthulhu, maybe? As they grow up with that. But you didn't ask that question.
I didn't ask that question.
And unfortunately, I was walking in the lakes, so I wasn't able to join you guys.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But I did think about that Cthulhu question, actually, but I didn't answer it. I didn't go there.
Just,
it didn't feel like the right mood.
I don't know. Oh, well.
So, anyway, so Things in the Flood is out there. If you listen to this podcast early enough, if we get it out early enough and you haven't already got it, then go for Things in the Flood. Remember, its predecessor won all those awards at the Ennies a couple of years back.
Mm. And is a great game that convinced me, even though I had my doubts about it. But, yeah.
So I've got my doubts about the other bit of news, which we thought we'd share anyway, partly for old time's sake and partly because we talked about it's talked about the IP, not necessarily this system, and that's the Judge Dredd and Worlds of 2000 AD Kickstarter. What are your thoughts on that, Dave?
I love Judge Dredd.
I thought you did.
You're deliberately, I just love him. I want to marry him. No, it's not quite this.
I think that's against the law, but
oh, it's okay. So, Mega City One is that kind of place, is it? Anyway, let's not go down that line.
Let's not go down that
line. We played a lot of Judge Dredd from back in the day in a
the GW system.
Yeah, which I really really enjoyed. I haven't kicked in for this one. I think there's a couple of reasons. One is I've had a little look at it, and I think the What's Old Is New dice system is fine. I'd quite like that. But it's got a very cartoony feel to it. And I guess naturally so, because it's taking 2000 AD and putting it into into a game. So, but I don't know, just right now I'm not in the mood for that kind of look and feel for a game. And I think my second reason is, although this might be a bad reason actually, the experience we had from the previous games, and if you're playing a judge, it does very much put the game on rails, I think, in a lot of cases, because you're talking about a judge who's got a crime and they've got to go and fix that. The players, if they're playing judges, have very little latitude to go and do something else. You couldn't go if you wanted to and do something completely different, whereas if you're playing...
Well, you can go if you want to and do something completely different, but the special judicial squad will come and kill you.
Yeah. I mean, but though this game, though, this Kickstarter for Judge Dredd does allow you to roll up and play civilians or perps, which is
all right.
Which I think, as I said, my argument here might be a bad one, but the experience we had with playing Judge Dredd back in the day, albeit great, and I really enjoyed running those games and playing them with Judge Iscariot, you know, burning hell sinner. Mm-hmm. For me as a GM, it feels like it's easy to get pushed on that quite narrow and linear focus for a game. Even though I'm kind of arguing with myself a bit here, you know, in the back of my mind.
You are, yeah. You'll have convinced yourself to buy it by the time we finish. I'll just sit back and say nothing and watch.
Possibly. Because some of my most memorable scenarios were ones that we ran playing Judge Dredd. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I'm being a bit harsh. I guess the third reason is I've got a lot of Kickstarters in the pipeline.
Yeah.
And I'm not kicking the door down to back this one, so I'm probably not going to back it. What about you?
I think that's the key thing. I've got too many games that I want to play, you know, and really I shouldn't even be backing Things in the Flood, to be honest.
But, yeah.
So I think I'll let this one go. I'll be interested to look at it when it hits the shops. I'd hope that somebody I know might play it one day or might run it one day. I wouldn't mind having a game for old time's sake.
Yeah, but, I'd love to play it, I think, but usually if I'm going to back something or buy something, I do so because I suspect I want to run it rather than just play it. Which is probably why I'm not going to go for Judge Dredd this time round. But talking about games that I do want to run, we've mentioned this many times before, but I'm only just mentioning it briefly. So Western, still going on. I don't know what the delivery date for that is now, but good news, obviously this summer that Tove's feeling a lot better and they're in a much better place. And that's great news, brilliant, brilliant news. But I on my holiday a couple of weeks ago, I always like to grab an impulse buy book. And this time I bought a book called Draw, The Greatest Gunfights of the American West, in order to get a feel and get some ideas for the Western campaign I'm going to run once I get the game for you guys. And that's really interesting. But a couple of things that come out of it, really, is how dangerous it is. Actually, or how dangerous it was in the Wild West. If you were going to shoot at somebody, you're likely to get yourself killed in a pretty horrible way. And also how pathetic most of the reasons for these gunfights are. It really is like school ground, you know, playground stuff, a lot of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, fascinating stuff. And it's given me some really good food for thought for the campaign that's going to come up once we get that lovely Western book in my hands.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that, and I think you know you're right to think we shouldn't be buying other stuff until stuff like that's delivered. And yeah, best wishes to Tove, who seems to be in remission at least, and we're looking forward to that getting delivered. It was going to be December, wasn't it? But I think it's probably going to be a bit later now.
I've kind of lost track of when to expect it. I mean, it's not a problem. I don't mind waiting at all, and certainly under the circumstances, I don't mind waiting in the slightest. I'm just keen to get my hands on it because I want to play it because I think it's going to be great.
Yeah. So something we have played is Forbidden Lands.
Yeah.
And we thought we might have a bit of a discussion about that and how it went in game.
Yeah. Go on then. So how did it go for you? how was it for you, Matthew?
Well, I've got to say, as GM, I felt a lot more comfortable with the rules this time than I did when I did a test of the beta version a while ago with my chums. I think I'm sure I got various things wrong, but I didn't feel like I was getting them as wrong as much as I was doing that beta version.
Yeah.
I like how it differs from Coriolis. Yeah, and I'm very much enjoying the procedural nature of the game in that, you know, we used The Hollows, which is a recommended sort of beginning scenario, but the way that game went was based a little bit on the dice rolls you made approaching it. So, you know, there were various options of things you could do in The Hollows. We went down a slightly spookier route there. We didn't end up with any conflict. We might have ended up, well, you fought a couple of ghosts, but there wasn't any really hard conflict there. There were enough stories in The Hollows that led to a situation that you guys resolved with differing levels of success. You've left the Hollows. You've left the Hollows to change place. You know, I think I know now that when you return there, if you return there, things will have happened, which I've written down, which are a consequence of your interaction with them in the first place.
Yeah.
So I'm beginning to see how this world, my version of the Forbidden Lands, would be different from yours if you were running it, or from anybody else's that's running it. And, you know, and the game is really well designed to make that happen, to make everybody's Forbidden Lands a different thing.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. That's it was really, really good fun. I think the first thing I'll sort of just mention and ask you about, get your sense. So obviously this game is going back to a much more Mutant Year Zero feel for in terms of its mechanics, which is great. And I like that. It's also putting greater weight, pressure, emphasis on your own personal condition. So whether you're cold, hungry, thirsty, or sleepless, that's a, you know, that's a mechanic in the game that really matters, in the same way that it does for Mutant. The thing I found when I ran Mutant was you have all these rules for generating on the fly the zones when you go through them when you're exploring. But I always found that as a GM really quite clunky. And I didn't like doing it at the table because I felt it slowed things down. So prior to a game, I would roll up the zones that the players might get to in that, in that next scenario, which would then be slowly building up my map of the zone, which is great. And maybe what I might do is pull out some of my old Mutant stuff from that campaign and stick it up on rpggods.org just so people can have a look at what I've done. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is, that procedural nature of the game, how does it feel to you for Forbidden Lands in terms of not knowing, nobody knows what's going to be in the next hex that we crawl into? How does it feel for you as a GM about managing it? Which way are you going to manage it?
Well, I think I'm going to go midway between the two approaches.
a third way.
I you could conceivably bring you guys to the entrance to a dungeon and then start rolling dice to define the shape of that dungeon and the creatures you meet in it.
Yeah.
From that point on, in play. Part of me is really inclined to do that one day, but I don't think I dare. Okay. There is that point that I'm rolling a lot of dice while you guys are watching.
Yeah, that's my feel. But I haven't actually tried it. So I've shied, in Mutant, I shied away from it without trying it. So it might be worth just
it
trying.
It could be worth us doing it at one point.
Yeah.
I'd like to give it a try from the whole thing, but I think my tendency is to do with us, you know, if we were designing a dungeon, that I'd do that in advance as you've done with zones. But I am very inclined to make the random encounters truly random, and as we did. So, you know, there's an interesting thing there. So you could argue that it might have been a rather frustrating game for you guys, because the two things that you met that you could have a fight with were both ghosts.
Yeah.
One of those was a scripted ghost, although there was a bit of a random choice about which of the ghosts in the Hollows you met, but you would have met a ghost in the Hollows, and we rolled up a ghost, and it was that ghost that attacked you.
And spoilers, then there was spoilers.
No. The ghost that attacked has already happened.
No, spoilers for other people who might play Forbidden Lands and the Hollows.
Right, okay.
So you know there might be a ghost in the Hollows.
There's another choice there. Oh yeah, oh good point. And then there was another random attack, a random encounter afterwards, which was another ghost that coincidentally attacked you. So, you know, story wise, if I was writing a story, I wouldn't necessarily say, well, then they fight a ghost, and then they fight a ghost in an entirely different and unconnected way. So there's that. That's the danger of procedural rolling. But
it didn't feel that way. It worked.
Yeah, it kind of worked in a way. And, you know, and that ghost now, that second ghost has a particular history. So if I roll him up again and he meets you again, actually, I think, you know, there might be a development of his story that comes out of that. So I'm going to stick, I think, with randomly rolled encounters and on the fly randomly rolled, not rolled necessarily before the adventure, but you could even say, right, okay, I expect them to be going through two or three hexes, you know, let's do those random encounter rolls in advance so that we're not stopping it through the game. But I think I'd be inclined to do those in game.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there, I think. So first and foremost, when I first, the very first time I saw Forbidden Lands was coming, and I saw, you know, the random encounter thing, my heart sank a little bit because it brought to mind random encounter tables from D&D, which in my experience back in the day was just a list of monsters that you might fight or creatures that you come across. So basically it's just another fight thrown into the game for no reason whatsoever. But having read the rules for Forbidden Lands and then having had the experience of the game that we played when you rolled up the random encounter, one, the random encounter details and tables they've put in are a lot more diverse. So there's loads of stuff in there.
Thought through.
And it's not just here's a hobgoblin you've got to fight. It's not just, here's a lion who comes out of the woods and eats you. It's a lot more thought about. And the point that you made there about, you know, if you now roll that ghost again, you're going to have it as the same ghost, and his story will have moved on as well as ours. So that becomes a kind of a subplot line in itself, which I love. I love that idea. But also in the game, there was a genuine sense of unpredictability when you were rolling up that random encounter, because it wasn't something you'd planned. You know, every game, a GM plans what's going to happen. This was genuinely... Okay, this is genuinely random. Something's going to happen and I don't know what it is. Nobody knows what it is. So it could be anything. And I like that sense. So I don't think rolling the random encounters at the table is a bad thing. I think that's actually a really positive thing if it's done in a good way.
Yeah, and that very first random encounter, you know, where I said, right, okay, you sent something and then I roll the dice and see what it is. That sets up a tension there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think worked for everybody. And, you know, at my heart, I'm a relatively low-prep GM as well, so...
We have noticed.
Yeah.
Not even reading the scenario before the game, kind of low-prep.
Which has happened. Which one are we talking about now?
I can't remember. There's been so many.
Yeah, so this I think is the toolkit that I need to make it look like I'm being low prep on purpose.
As opposed to being just disorganised.
As opposed to just being disorganised, exactly.
Yeah, no. It was good. I mean, I really enjoyed the game. I really enjoyed the experience of randomly rolling up my character, even though joked on the day that, you know, I rolled up the most boring possible race I could in the
But you haven't, have you?
I haven't now, no. Haven't. I really. I mean, well, I did have
did
a second roll
from a human.
Yeah, I did. But I'm liking my elf very much now. As a character. You know, we this was a one-off for us initially, but I think we've all got a connection to the
characters. You all seem to want to play the campaign now.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I don't want to roll up a new character. I want to play the guy that I've rolled up and played once already. So that's good, really good. The random generation is a nice change. Again, I think I've spoken before about, you know, so many games nowadays don't have much of a random element, you know, if any, really, in character generation. Sometimes it's nice to be given something that you go, oh, okay, what have I got here? And then you make it work. And that was refreshing to do that again. I liked it very much. So, yeah, it was a good idea of yours to make us randomly roll the characters up.
Yeah. And, of course, I guess that is a nice segue into what we plan to do at Dragon Meet this year.
We're so good, aren't we? I mean, we're just smoothly segueing from one thing to the next. Yeah, anyone would think we'd been doing this for a year.
First of all, let's hashtag podcast zone, hashtag Dragon Meet.
Yep.
We will be at Dragon Meet as part of the podcast zone this year in the first weekend of December.
I think it's December.
Which I think is the second.
It is the 1st of December.
The very 1st. Sorry, yeah. So it's a Saturday. So if you're London-based or can get to London, come and join us at Dragon Meet, which is London's friendliest tabletop gaming convention. And we'll be there with the podcast zone, so you can come and have a chat with us about anything. But there's something specific that we are planning, and we're working with our fellow podcast zoners to make it happen. and that is a random character generation for Forbidden Lands characters, and then a sort of, I wouldn't call it a mini scenario, but then should we call it a challenge?
It's the Coriolis effect, Forbidden Lands, Grindbone, Slavers Tournament. Come on, big
it's
it up.
It's the Grindbone Slavers Tournament.
Bloody hell.
Big it up, yes.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to roll a character.
This is a kind of scenario thing. And yeah, that's really exciting. Right, guys, this is a tournament. You get to come along, roll up characters randomly, and then you fight each other. And then the person who wins, who survives through to the final, do they win a prize? I don't know. If we can get some prizes,
well, I don't
out
know. We'll have to think about a prize.
The prize would be a hug from Matthew. So,
at the very least, it'll be a hug from me. Or maybe the top prize is not a hug from me. Anyway, yeah, we'll think about prizes. But what we've got to begin with is the opportunity to roll up a character with one of us, with all the books, the way you do it in the Legends and Adventurers kit. That gives you a bunch of equipment as well, some of which may be useful, some of which may not be useful if you find yourself in the slave pits of Grindbone. Bad luck, because the next thing you'll do is in pairs, you'll be fighting another pair of players in a knockout tournament, and you will come to love your characters as you watch them die, or as you watch them get broken. Actually, it'll be interesting to see how many of them actually die and how many just get broken and dragged off the field. And our deal is the Slavers of Grindbone have agreed with us that anybody who participates in the tournament is released in whatever state they are with all their original possessions, or the ones that didn't break in the actual fight. And so you get to keep your character sheet and start a Forbidden Lands campaign of your very own back in your house with the character that you've grown to love.
Yeah, indeed. So we'll have sign-up sheets on the morning, and then we will be running that in the afternoon at Dragon Meet in our Podcast Zone recording studio.
And we're working with let's give a shout out to the Forble Gamer as well.
Yep, go, Dan.
The Forble Gamer will be providing the recording equipment for that. So not only will you roll up a character and will you fight, but you'll be recorded doing so. And then we'll release the tournament in some form on future episodes of this very podcast.
Indeed. So yeah, hopefully that should be a lot of fun. Looking forward to a bit of fun there. And just as I say, if you want to come along and sign up, find us in the morning. We'll have a number of slots, but obviously a finite number. So if you're keen to join, then come and find us early, and be ready to roll up a halfling peddler who has got no fighting skills whatsoever, but you can do your best. Anyway, you still might win. You never
might not have any fighting skills. He'll still have a couple of dice to roll.
He will have dice to roll, yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Just before we leave the subject of Forbidden Lands, obviously the news of the merger between the Iron Ring and the Free League to become the Iron League. They're going to stay the Free League.
They are staying the Free
League.
Let's
not confuse
everybody. No, absolutely.
You did talk about the exciting possibility of Simba Room with a lovely Mutant Year Zero dice pool.
Yes.
Now, that's not going to happen, but has playing Forbidden Lands given you any ideas about how we might play Simba Room in future in your campaign?
Well, what it has done is flagged to me that I think one of the key intentions of Simba Room for a Simba Room game that I think Mateus and Mateus had in mind was a hex crawling kind of game where you go into the Forest of Davakar and you search for treasure. And we haven't done that. The way we've set up our campaign is very different, kind of deliberately so, because I wanted to have something that was a little narrower in scope and sort of smaller stories rather than the big stories that we've been playing in Game of Thrones, for example, in the campaign that I've been running there, which were very much about kings and lords and events that affect the whole land. I wanted something that was a bit smaller scale, a bit sort of homegrown. So I think there's one thing that's come out of Forbidden Lands is actually there is that element for Simba Room of treasure hunting. But I don't think that's necessarily what's going to happen in this particular campaign with Potboy and the two changelings. unless you guys want to do that. You know, it's obviously up to you. The other thing, I really like the Year Zero engine, as we know. Mm-hmm. I would quite like to maybe just have a go at running Simbaroom with it, but I do wonder if that might take away some of the Simbaroom-ness of the game. And if I'm going to do that, why don't I just run Forbidden Lands? Yeah, because we've got the game there with that system in it. But I still have a sort of nagging doubt, nagging feeling about the D20 mechanic. I don't really like the binary nature of that. I don't mind it, but I don't like it as much as I like a dice pool system. So I've been thinking, and we've talked a little bit about, is there a way of trying to just change the mechanics a little bit, tweak the mechanics for Simbaroom, whilst keeping its look and feel, but making it a bit less off a cliff if you succeed or fail. And we discussed before, well, maybe we add a second dice, so you get to roll two dice. And if you succeed on either of those, you get a success. If you succeed on both, you get a bonus to your
An
success.
Extraordinary success or something. Yeah.
Which I think is a possible idea, but what you've done there is simply upped the chances of succeeding. You've just given your player a second chance at every single roll, so they're going to succeed more often. Is that right? I'm not sure.
Well, given the nature of this world of Simbaroom, which is meant to be dark and painful, is it right? You know, I guess it makes it a little bit more pulpy.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I mean, there could be an element in that which, you know, me as the GM could try and manage, which would be you get to roll two dice, but if you succeed on only one, you get a lesser success. So you increase the chances of success, but you take away a little bit of the extent of that success.
Mm.
You could also perhaps say, I could let the players roll as many dice as they want, but the more dice they roll, the weaker the success becomes. Up to a limit, that might be an option. I just had that thought this very second, actually. Because I was thinking, we're going to play the next scenario in the Lonesome Ogre campaign in 8 days, a week tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I've already thought in that there are some things, some skills, some roles you can make, which actually I think you can roll more dice. So, for example, there are one example would be if you're trying to find out information about something from the town, say, you could roll three dice, and the number of successes you get then tells you how much information you find. So you don't find absolutely no information, or you don't find absolutely everything. The number of successes lands you somewhere on that spectrum. So I'm going to try that in the next game for those things. But that in of itself doesn't automatically work in a much more binary situation of combat, say, where either you hit somebody or you don't. But the idea of having more dice, that the players could then decide how many dice they want to roll, accepting that if they only get one success, they're going to get a much reduced outcome of that attack or that action. I quite like that idea. What? How does that sound? Yeah. What's your thought?
Well, that sounds like an intriguing idea. So it isn't so much the binary note. Well, it isn't so much the chance of failure being any different with a D20 over a dice pool system. It's the fact that there isn't, you know, as you say, that very binary nature that a failure is a failure and a success is a success.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of maybe having a mechanic where you can have a strong success or a weaker success, which is what the dice pool manages to do in Coriolis and the other games we play. But yeah, we're going to have to test it out.
Yeah, I think I will give that a go, and I think I'll give the option to the player. I'll let the player decide whether they want to roll one, two, or three dice, say. But obviously, the more dice you roll, the weaker the effect will be. Yeah, let's try that in a couple of weeks. Cool.
Okay, we'll give that a go.
I knew
report back on it. You knew it was going to be
a worthwhile discussion. Talking about this,
a worthwhile discussion. Excellent.
Which it was.
Now, actually. And that's a nice segue into a thing that I must admit I was hoping to have tried in play before now. As it turns out, since we last spoke about the Al Mudahir campaign, we haven't been able to play. And in fact, I'm going to have to take about a month off to concentrate on my PhD. So I'm not going to get a chance to do this for a month. So I was hoping to talk about the next thing that we're going to talk about with some knowledge of actually having played it. I haven't tested it out. But let's talk about extended manipulation challenges.
Yeah, cool.
You have heard me grumble about the reputation of manipulation mechanics in Coriolis. My biggest gripe, as I explained in Season 1, Episode 17, is the potential for two starting characters to have a modifier of plus or minus 6 on manipulation rolls. A few weeks ago, I played the quick start for the new Expanse RPG. It didn't make me want to kick in for the game, but I did like their social encounter rules. In that system, you have to work on building a relationship with your interlocutor, winning them over with a sequence of approaches and roles. For example, though they might be suspicious of you to begin with, you might buy them a drink to shift their attitude to a more neutral one. Then you might, for example, flirt with them to make their attitude more positive, friendly even. Then hit them with the question you really wanted to ask in the first place. We'd recently been playing Tales from the Loop, and this longer social encounter mechanic reminded me of Extended Trouble from that Year Zero engine game. That is only really used in the climactic scene of an adventure. Most of the troubles player characters face in loop adventures can be overcome, or not, with one simple roll. Remember, in loop, the GM doesn't roll. It's a player-facing game. So I thought, could we create something like an extended trouble for more dramatic manipulation roles? I think we can. Now, I have to be clear. I've not tested it in play yet. I'm having to take some time away from my local group, so the opportunity to do so won't come up for a month or so. But this is my idea. Rather than use the difference in reputation as a modifier on manipulation rolls, make it a target. Make it the number of successes one party has to roll to manipulate the other. 1. Work out the difference between the reputation of the person you want to manipulate and that of the member of your party present in the scene with the lowest reputation. Which is to say that you may well be a courtesan with a high manipulation skill and an excellent reputation. But if you brought with you your humanoid soldier with a rep of 1 or 2, or 0, it's that reputation you're comparing, not yours. Face man always work best without BA around. 2. That difference is the target, the number of successes you need to get, though it never goes below 1. You always have to get 1 success, of course, which means that between 2 characters with the same reputation, manipulation rolls will work pretty much as they do already. The same would be true if the characters had 1 rank of reputation difference between them, although the die modifier that the rules mandate would not apply under this system. 3. If the target is between 1 and 2, or maybe 3, the manipulator can risk a single die roll. If it is 4 or more, an extended manipulation attempt is required. The manipulator, and their allies if they wish, must work their way to achieving the objective. 4. Make a series of social gambits, which might include offers or requests for hospitality, the exchange of gifts, ceremonial tea, compliments, chat-up lines, etc., banking your successes against the target. 5. Each role will be modified by your opponent's attitude towards you. 0 modifier if their attitude is neutral, -1 die if they're suspicious of you, -2 dice if they're hostile, maybe -3 dice when there are other aggravating circumstances. You can get positive modifiers too. Maybe +1 die if they owe you a favour, or +2 if they are a real friend already. 6. You must bank at least 1 success against your target with every roll. If you fail to do so at any stage, the extended manipulation challenge is over. If you get extra successes with any roll, you can bank them against your target too, or you can spend no more than one extra success to reduce a negative modifier by one die. 7. When you are close to your target, you can risk asking your opponent for your objective. If you achieve your target number of successes with previous social gambits, you still need to make one more roll to ask for your objective. So, for example, if you want a favour from some high-ranking factionary, you might need 6 or 7 successes, but you don't need them all in one roll. You would, of course, if you demanded that favour straight away, but a wise traveller in the Third Horizon knows not to be so rude. You and your crew know how to be polite, so you might start by humbly requesting hospitality and make a roll for that, maybe with one less die because the factionary is suspicious of your motives, and you earn 1 or 2 successes. Bank those against your target and compliment your host upon the quality of their baklava. You earn another couple of successes here and choose to spend 1 to reduce his suspicions to a neutral attitude. Offer to pour the tea. Roll and earn another couple of successes. That's 4 successes against your target of 6. You could butter up the factionary, but time is short. You ask for the favour and roll. You can always offer a prayer to the icons if you say the wrong thing.
I like this, but I've got a couple of thoughts. So I think the thing that I really like is the idea that you can slowly influence somebody and convince them to come around to your way of thinking, rather than having to do it, as we were talking about a minute ago, in a very binary way. Either you persuade them right now or you don't. So I really like that extended manipulation sort of process that you've got in here. Yeah, and my experience, limited as it is, of the extended trouble in Tales from the Loop, which we've only played the once, but that extended trouble worked really well, I thought, at the end of that scenario, and I was a bit dubious about it. But it worked. It worked brilliantly. So I think there is stuff here that could work really, really well. I'm assuming that this process can be played out across, a whole afternoon's game. So you start the game trying to persuade someone. It's only at the end of that game. Or do you see it as like extended trouble in Tales from the Loop, that you kind of resolve it all as one thing at the table at that moment?
Well, I think you've got some options. So extended trouble, one of the things I haven't made explicit in what I've just said is, of course, with the extended trouble in Tales in the Loop, the whole party has to contribute.
Yeah.
Everybody rolls a dice. The leader might make some bonuses on that, depending on how they do it.
That's because it's kind of summarising a scene of the programme.
Exactly,
there might be 5
yeah.
minutes in a couple of rolls, yeah.
And so I think one of the things you could do is have different members of your party contributing to the success. It doesn't all have to be the face man doing all the rolls.
Yeah.
So it could be quite flexible in that regard. But it could just be the face man doing all the rolls and the guys sitting idly or standing idly by and just being set dressing or menacing or whatever. But yeah, you raise the interesting prospect of maybe it taking time. So you bank these roles over a number of scenes.
Yeah.
And admittedly, I hadn't really thought about that. I'd thought about effectively saying, there have been a couple of times when, we've had a scenario where there hasn't been much shooting because we've been talking our way out of it and manipulating people out of it. And actually, those scenes have worked pretty well. Mm. But in a way, it's a trying to stretch out one of those scenes. So if your climactic confrontation at the end of it is actually a talky conversation and not a shooty one, how do you get a thing where everybody contributes and rolls some dice and there's some tension that just drags it out a little bit and makes it into a proper scene? But yeah, there's no reason why you couldn't do it over a course of time. And there could be, let's send this gift in advance. Let's buy this gift now, send it to him, and then we're going to meet him next Tuesday or whatever. I think, that could work quite well.
It's interesting because there's a parallel in Game of Thrones, Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game, which they call intrigue, which is basically like combat, but for manipulating people. And that works really well. But it is a bit complicated, and your chances of success are modified by how the person you're talking to feels about you, and there are some quite complicated rules to work out, you know, what their disposition to you is, and vice versa. So it just becomes a bit clunky. Although it does work, quite well if you don't sort of worry too much about, you know, going by the letter of the rules to make sure you've got it exactly as the rules say you should. But, you know, so the way I run these things, if, you know, people have probably noticed, is if it feels right and it's just about right, I'll run with it rather than spend hours going through the rule book to make sure it's exactly right to the last decimal point.
Maximum game fun.
Precisely, yeah. How complicated do you feel this would be for you as a GM to manage?
Well, I've tried to make it simple.
Yeah.
So the key thing is you've got to work out the difference. So it doesn't, if the difference isn't massive, actually it doesn't change much at all to the current system. If you're two people who are of a like sort of rank in terms of reputation, then it kind of gets rid of the modifier and gives you some different modifiers which are more attitudinal based. So, but I think my I'll try to keep my modifiers very simple. So there's an idea of, you know, if they're entirely neutral, there are no modifiers. If they're your mate, it's plus one or plus two. If they're suspicious of you, it's minus one or minus two. Or if, you know, if there's extenuating circumstances, like you've just had a gunfight, maybe it's minus three, but that's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then that fits in with the modifiers on all the other roles in Coriolis, which are only ever modified by 1 to 3, effectively.
Yeah.
And you can even, you don't need to use those modifiers. In a way, you could just roll the dice if you wanted to make it even simpler.
Yeah.
The key thing is, what is the difference between your reputation and theirs?
Yeah, and that's interesting, because there's a point here that I'm going to sort of pull out, which you talk about the difference, you know, the reputation difference is between the person you're trying to manipulate and the member of your party who's present, who's got the lowest reputation. Now, I can kind of see how that might work in certain circumstances. But if you've got, let's say, some noble person who's going to have a high reputation trying to manipulate somebody, and they've got their manservant with them who's got a low reputation, it doesn't feel right that the reputation difference should be based on the manservant rather than the person, because surely the person you're trying to manipulate, the person you're trying to manipulate will be influenced by the person of highest reputation in that group rather than the lowest.
I guess, you know, that's a fair point. If you imagine, I've spent some of my time being an 18th century manservant in my professional life, weirdly. And of course, as such, I'm almost like a badge of honour for the person that I'm following around. You know, the fact that you've got these people standing on your left-hand shoulder just behind you all the time is in itself a badge of rank.
It's a demonstration of your...
of your power and reputation, exactly. But I guess with that, I was thinking of the normal scum and villainy that a player character group descends into.
Yeah.
So I was thinking it's not so much about you and your manservant. It's about, as I say, Face Man and B.A. Baracus. B.A. Baracus, let us remind ourselves, is called B.A. because he has a bad attitude.
Yeah.
So, yes. So, yeah, his reputation would negatively affect you, whereas, you know, an actual manservant, I think, probably wouldn't. It probably needs some tweaking in that regard. I need to think about that without making it too complicated.
Yeah, it's probably, though, it's a bit situational, isn't it? And maybe it's then up to the GM to decide how it applies, depending upon the circumstances you're... your characters are actually facing at that moment.
Yeah,
cool. Yeah, the last thing I was going to mention. So how does it work? I can see how it works if you've got a lower reputation than the person you're trying to influence. What if you've got a much higher reputation than the person you're trying to influence? How does that work?
Yeah, well, I didn't make this specific, but in my head, I'm thinking it works in exactly the same way. So it isn't a positive or negative modifier like it is in the book. It's simply that you are of such a different reputational class, that person, that if you're a posh person trying to convince, let's not use the word posh, if you've got a high reputation, trying to convince somebody with a low reputation to do something for you, you're going to need to work just as hard.
Yeah. How do you decide the target number then in that instance?
So let's say you've got reputation of 9 and you are talking to a hoodlum with a reputation of 3, which is still pretty high, actually. Then you've got a gap of 6 between you. If he were trying to convince you to do a thing, it would be six successes he needs to get. But actually, if you want to convince this oik to do something for you, you've got to get six successes too to convince him.
Okay,
to
right,
trust you.
Right. I get it.
But I didn't make that explicit because I'm not sure about that rule.
Although I think that works, though, because the opposite, again, it'll be situational, won't it? But just because some noble toff comes along and tries to influence some, some low-level street urchin or something, just because that person's got a high reputation in his circles, that might have a negative impact on the street urchin. It might be, sod off, toff, I hate you and your sort.
That's exactly my thought. Or even, they might say, they tip their cap to you, Soror, and look like they're doing the thing, but then just run off with the money or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't worked it out. I really want to play the rules and see whether
I'm interested.
It makes sense.
Well, maybe it'll come up when we have our weekend away.
Yeah. Since you're all on a prison planet then, and therefore effectively got a reputation of quite low, maybe not. But we'll see.
Depends how long we're on the prison planet for, I guess.
Cool. Yeah. What was I going to say? I think you've said an important point, and you've mentioned a couple of times it's situational. And I think this is an optional rule. It isn't one to use every time.
Yeah.
It's when the encounter really matters.
Yeah.
And
where you gain something for not having the whole manipulation rely upon just one role.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's interesting. I'm doing this just as Ricard has published on Facebook the G+ group his simplified combat. So if you don't, if you want to reduce combat to just one role, there's a system for doing that.
Yeah.
And here I am saying if you want to do social interaction to increase it to more than one role, here's a system to do that.
Well, two things there. One, I think certainly in Coriolis, combat is so short that I don't feel the need to shorten it any further, but I guess some people might do, depending on how many protagonists you got in the fight. But for this one, the manipulation, I could see running a whole scenario just about influencing somebody and trying to persuade them to a certain course of action using this kind of rule. I think it's a really nice addition. Good work, Matt.
Brilliant. Okay, now tell me, or you have told me already, but not you haven't said very much about it. You had some interesting moral choices for your players in the Spectral Corsair campaign.
Yes, we had a game this week, and unfortunately it was the first one when two of my players have gone back to university, so both of my sons have gone off to uni, so they weren't around. Paul couldn't make it either, unfortunately, so we had three of us, and then Pete had to leave early, so it ended up with only being Tony and Connor for the last hour. But that didn't really matter. So if you remember, they just fled Coriolis, having suddenly agreed to spirit away Sister Mariam, who had been, they thought, a witch smeller from the Covenstead of Phocas from Zalos that they were trying to kill. She's told them that she's actually an operative of Alarm's Temple, and she'd been infiltrating the Covenstead for their purposes. And so they agreed to try and get her back to Menkar so she could report back what was happening. And they then fled Coriolis. So we decided that Agit and Osgar, which are Morgan and Dean's characters, have left in Morgan's ship to go back and report to the Legion because they've left without permission and cover the escape of the others with Sister Mariam. So that explains their absence quite nicely, thankfully. So they decided to go to Trini in Iwaz on their way to Menkar, but the first thing they needed to do was find some work. So they went and have picked up some passengers and have got some cargo, which they found on Trini. But whilst they were there, Hanbel spotted a person he thought looked exactly the same as the third Zelosian target they were supposed to be investigating on Coriolis. And this guy is called Robart Alfaco. And he'd been negotiating with Sidalians on Coriolis about an alliance between Sidal and Zalos to bring Sidal into the war. They heard about this and they overheard them, Alfaco, talking to some mooks in a cantina about having to meet a certain person and time is of the essence and they've got to get going. So even though they weren't part of the Legion anymore, this piqued Hanbal's interest. And they had a bit of a question of, well, why are we bothering with him? You know, if we don't work for the Legion anymore, what do we care? Let's just get to Menkar. But Hanbal followed him to Moeen's Silver Palace, which is a complex of theatres and hotels with a hammam and a casino and a saloon bar, and was trying to work out basically what he was up to. Subsequently, they spoke to Sister Mariam about it, and she said, well, look, don't care whether you're working for the Legion or not. If Sadal joins the war with Zalos, then it's going to extend the war. It's going to be much worse. Many more people are going to die. We've got to stop Alfaco passing whatever message it is he's got, passing it on. He's got to die. We've got to kill him. So they managed to infiltrate.
She's a lovely person, isn't she?
Well, for the greater good of the Third Horizon, and saving thousands of war. You know, tens of thousands of innocent lives. You know, the needs of the many and all that outweigh the needs of the few. So they're having this little debate about, well, actually, I don't mind killing Alfaco. He's Zelosian. He's a bad guy. Yes, why not? We can do that. They managed to infiltrate themselves into their group, Alfaco's group, and were putting themselves forward as, you know, the ship's captain that is being arranged to take them forward towards Sadal, which is where they wanted to go. And in the group, Alfaco had met a Sadalian poet called Mahar, who was a world-renowned poet but was obviously working as Alfaco's contact. There were also a couple of other Sadalians with him as well who were going to be going on the ship. So they finally agreed that, yes, there will be the ship, the Spectral Corsair will take them onto Sadal, in the full knowledge that they were going to get them on the ship and kill them. So this was fine. You know, they'd work this out. And it was all going well until it got to the point when they were actually on the ship. And they came into the cargo bay, they closed the cargo bay doors, and suddenly Norsa, the Neketra, who'd built up a bit of a relationship with the poet, was like, I can't kill him. I don't want to kill the poet. This is not fair. Tony killed Alfaco quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And sort of put him down quite happily. He's got a hatred of first come, and I spent a couple of darkness points in the game to kick that in for him a little bit, because all these people are first come. So he was quite happy killing Alfaco, and they managed to kill him without too much trouble. They then had a bit of a fight on the cargo deck, and this was the debate. So it was a debate between, yes, they got that Alfaco needed to die, but did they need to kill the others as well? So there were, in effect, three kind of innocent people who they were going to cold-bloodedly murder. And they had a bit of an argument about whether or not this was the right thing to do. And they eventually reasoned that if they let them go, not only are they at risk because these people will have witnessed them murdering Alfaco, but perhaps they would even draw Sadal closer to Zalos in that situation. So it might... By killing Alfaco and not killing them, they might have actually served Zalos' purposes to bring Sadal into the war on their side. So they had quite a debate about this, but in the end, they decided to kill them. And Hanbal was very cold-blooded in finishing off the poet. He'd met him earlier on and had tried to fool the poet to draw him into a conversation that he was a great fan of the poet. But then the poet said, okay, well, which of my works is your favourite? And so obviously he couldn't get out of that. So he then had to admit that he didn't really know his work, but he could tell he was a great artist. And then Tony, playing Hanbal at the end, when he was finishing off this poor poet, Mahar, had to say, yeah, I hate your poetry, it's shit, before he killed him. Just to really cold-bloodedly do it. And then Sister Mariam was, well done. You know, welcome to the world of Alarm's Temple, where you've had your first cold-blooded murder for the good of the horizon. And that was the end of the scenario. But it worked out really well, and the guys really enjoyed it and had a lot of backwards and forwards debating about, you know, what was going to be a quadruple cold-blooded murder. But they did it in the end. But it worked out. It was a good, really good scenario. Looking forward to the next one.
Cool. So, next episode, what are we talking about?
Liberator.
Liberator. Yeah, I ought to explain a little bit about why I've commissioned you to do this. So in my next scenario, it's terrible. I'm giving spoilers away to the person who's playing in the scenario.
I know, you've already done that, though. It's a bit late.
But I'm giving it to everybody else now.
It does feel a bit weird. I have this vision. It does feel a bit weird that I'm going to be... Or you have half designed the ship that I don't know I'm going to find yet.
Yes.
Anyway, go on.
So I got this vision of four towers stuck in a sort of ice floe on this prison planet, and the people around you kind of treat it like some sort of temple, but it's actually an ancient craft based on the Liberator from Blake 7. Mm. And I know you like designing ships. I could have designed the ship myself, but given that I'm taking away a ship that you personally designed, I thought it was only fair to let you design it. So you'll come back and tell us all about the Liberator in the next scenario, in the next episode, which will be before we've played it, so you won't even have discovered it yet.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anything else? Should we have a look at another one of the factions?
Yeah. Have you got one that you want to look at?
We haven't done Alarm's Temple, have we?
I did that.
Who did Alarm's Temple?
Yeah.
Where are we at?
How could you not remember?
Oh, it was a classic, Dave. It was a classic.
It was. You said,
seared into my memory.
You did say, oh, that's so great. I really, really want to play Alarm's Temple now.
Ah, yeah. No, that was it. Yeah, yeah. But I've moved on from that. I'm all about Forbidden Lands now. I tell you what, I think what I was saying when we haven't looked at the Draconites, have we?
We've done so many, actually. I can't remember. I don't think we have. Not in...
Tell you what, our homework will be to
work out which
one we haven't done, and then do that one, or do one of those that we haven't done.
Yeah. Excellent. Good. I'm glad you worked that out.
Brilliant. Okay, we'll see you in 3 weeks or so.
Yep.
But in the meantime, may the icons bless your adventures.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to The Coriolis Effect, presented by Fiction Suit with the RPG Gods, with music by Stars on a Black Sea, used with permission of Free League Publishing. Imagery from NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope, brought to you by Wikimedia Commons. Typeface is Code by FontFabric.